Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Trump declares a public health emergency on the opioid crisis.
We can be the generation that ends the opioid epidemic. We can do it.
How will the president's declaration affect Massachusetts? Also today, Amazon wants a virtual set of your house keys. Plus, author Brynonia Berry on using the city of Salem in her novels.
I think in order to have the fiction be believable, you really need to make sure everything else is. And in Salem, you know, if you change a location, you know, you better say so in your acknowledgments because people will call you on it.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, President Trump made it official today. He is declaring the nation's opioid epidemic a public health emergency.
As Americans, we cannot allow this to continue. It is time to liberate our communities from this scourge of drug addiction. Never been this way. We can be the generation that ends the opioid epidemic. We can do it.
The limited 90-day emergency declaration would allow certain laws and regulations to change, and some grant money could then be used to address the opioid epidemic. Some say the president's declaration does not go far enough, though, and does not provide the funding needed to deal with a public health crisis that kills tens of thousands of people in the United States every year. Massachusetts was one of the first states to declare an emergency because of the opioid crisis, and that was back in 2014. Joining us to talk about this is WBUR's Martha Biebinger. Hi there, Martha.
Hey, Deb.
So overall, what does this public health emergency do?
For Massachusetts or for the country?
For Massachusetts.
Yeah, so it's not really clear that it does a whole lot. We haven't heard about any new major funding stream. We had reaction already from the Massachusetts Medical Society saying we need more resources, from Attorney General Maura Healey saying we need money to help with prevention, we need more treatment, we need the federal government to step in to try to curb the price of naloxone, the drug that's used to reverse many overdoses, and we didn't hear details of any of that. What we do know is that a public health emergency allows the president to tap into the public health emergency fund, which currently has $57,000 in it, much, much less than what most people would say we need right now on a yearly basis to try to curb overdose deaths.
And the president did say, though, that this declaration would make it easier for states to, or make it easier to improve access to medications to treat addiction. So what do we know about what that might mean for patients in particular?
There was a briefing with some White House officials and reporters earlier in the day that talked about expanding the use of telehealth. So appointments over phone or video to try to increase access to some of the drugs that are used to curb the cravings for opioid medications. But there's very little research, Deb, on whether telehealth is an effective way not only to expand access, but to help people stay on those meds and therefore reduce overdoses and deaths.
You mentioned some of the local reaction that we're hearing about as well. Attorney General Healey said that families need expanded access to substance use treatment. These are actions we can take right now, and this announcement does little to support any of them. But of course, the reaction we really want to hear is from Governor Baker, who served on President Trump's Opioid Commission. And what do we know, anything yet from the governor about, I know the president's announcement just wrapped up, but what about Governor Baker?
He's expected to have an availability for reporters within the hour. What we know from him, Deb, is you listened to him speak at a hearing of that commission last Friday. We know that he signed off on a report calling for bold action, calling for a national emergency, which would be a much more sweeping declaration than this more limited, specifically public health emergency. We know that his office has asked for some waivers that would help the state combat opioid addiction and give them more opportunities to go for treatment. You had pointed out to me that one of the things President Trump suggests is stopping an exclusion so that people who go for treatment in facilities that are kind of labeled as mental health facilities can get Medicaid reimbursement. I know this starts to get kind of technical, but there are some very specific ways that the federal government can stop siloing, you know, sort of putting people in these specific categories of either mental health or addiction. And that's one of the things that Baker has asked for. But whether he's going to come out and say this doesn't go far enough, what we heard today, you know, stay tuned.
Right. And that particular rule that you're talking about in terms of siloing and allowing treatment, I mean, that the Opioid Commission, on which Baker sits, was one of its main recommendations and said it would free up treatment probably the most quickly out of any other action that the federal government could take, allowing this Medicaid payments to be used for treatment facilities that are somewhat larger. So the president did say that that was happening, but the money issue is going to be key. It seems as if the president is sort of saying, let Congress deal with this in a way and let Congress figure out how money might or might not be appropriated here.
It sounded like he was going to ask for some additional appropriation, although he did not commit to a specific amount. And, of course, we know that relations between the White House and Capitol Hill have been rocky on a number of issues. We know that they've just passed the budget resolution that really did not seem to take any of this into account. So people are somewhat frustrated by not hearing him commit to a specific number and a means to get to that number.
And just we should remember that Massachusetts was the first state to declare the opioid crisis an emergency, and that was back in 2014 under then-Governor Deval Patrick, allocating $20 million to deal with it. And things have only appeared to get worse. So some might say, you know, money's not the only thing, right?
Well, so
if worse means higher death rates.
Worse does mean higher death rates. There are lots of reasons for that, as you know, fentanyl being a big one. The president did talk about trying to, you know, crack down on labs in China and in Mexico that are producing the fentanyl. But on that point, Deb, of whether the emergency that Governor Patrick declared and that Governor Baker has really followed up on, Dr. Dorkin from the Medical Society addressed that fairly directly in his statement just about a half an hour ago. He said that making that declaration was an important wake-up call for many people in the state, and it did encourage doctors to pay more attention to things like the prescription monitoring program, where they can check in to see whether patients, how much opioids they're getting and from how many different sources, not just opioids, benzodiazepines, other things. And he thinks that is making a difference. You can see those prescribing rates start to drop. Now, that's not going to translate right away into fewer overdoses or fewer deaths, but I think there's an indication in Massachusetts that having taken that first step in 2014, having put that money in, may have helped start to contain the epidemic, at least to some small degree here.
Okay. WBUR's Martha Biebinger, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.
I want to go now to Ray Tomasi. He's president and founder of Gosnold on Cape Cod. Ray, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Deb. Thanks. Good to hear you.
So, Ray, tell us, what do you take from this announcement from President Trump today?
Well, I guess the good news is that it's been declared a public health emergency. The not so good news is that we were hoping, I think, that it was going to be elevated to the national emergency level because I'd have to look at some of the details about public health emergencies and what that really involves. But the bigger issue is that I think there would have been much more funding and targeted funding. As I understand it, from what I've seen thus far, is that there's no specific reference to an amount of funds that are associated with this. So it's compared to where we've been for the last 15 years on this issue. We've moved up the chain a little bit. not quite at the level that I think many of us were hoping. This issue requires a massive investment and a targeted investment, and I'm not sure that we got it out of this announcement today.
So what do you think the White House could feasibly do, Ray, to help? If this falls short primarily because of a lack of funding, what should the White House be doing?
Well, I think there are, I think you're now saying if there was adequate funding available, where would that funding best be targeted? And off the top, I'd say there are four or five areas. One of them certainly has to do with opening up access to medication, the addiction medications that are available for opioid treatment, and making them more available and getting them to areas that, as I understand it, there's some areas in the country where there's no access at all to that. So I think distributing those tools, making them available, and then educating people about how they can be used to help people. There's still a dichotomy, even in the addiction treatment field, about whether medications are necessary or not. And I think we should get through that, face the reality that these are not perfect medications, but they will help. The other is to really to do a much, much more aggressive campaign in changing the way we use pain medication in this country, through education, but also through public campaigns that help individuals, patients, know that these medications come with a risk. We've got to stop the flow of new users into the pipeline, as well as taking care of the people who have already progressed to the point where they're addicted to the medication. So clearly this whole crisis has come out of some not so great prescribing practices, and that's one of the areas that needs to be targeted also.
Well, the president did say that he was looking at prescribing practices, that he talked about limits on new prescriptions, similar to what we have here in Massachusetts. He also talked about an advertising campaign for prevention, a major advertising campaign, because he said if young people learn early not to do drugs, they won't.
Well, I've, in my experience, I have not seen that simply educating people about the negative aspects of drug or alcohol use translates directly into changed behaviors. And I think over the years we've seen that with other things. So yes, we need to educate. We also need to do a much better job of getting the behavioral health services into the general medical field so that we can start to screen people better, identify them sooner, treat them sooner, help physicians who are seeing most of the patients, help them understand that this is a condition that falls into the area of healthcare. It's not a sideline. Mind and body need to come together. I think that would do an awful lot to help stem this. It's like any other condition. The earlier you identify it, the more aggressively you treat it earlier, the less likely you are to have these high rates of severity.
Being a provider, because Gosnold is a treatment provider, and I'm just wondering, last question here, what you think of the president's plan that calls for improving the access to medicated-assisted treatment for addiction, but uses telemedicine to do it. Do we know enough about using medications, addiction medications for people, and distributing those through telemedicine to be able to expand that right now? Or what's your thinking on that, Ray?
I think telemedicine definitely has a role because it'll improve access, particularly to hard-to-reach areas and rural areas. I think the difficulties we've had in this period with medications is that they are sometimes being prescribed and not monitored properly. So I would certainly support a little bit more of an ambitious effort to educate providers and prescribers about the medications and begin to get some standards. They already exist for how to best deliver this care. I don't think that's the case in universally across the country. So you've got medications that can help. You have prescribers who perhaps are less than well-informed about how to monitor that. But these are, once you've established a relationship with a patient, you could sustain this kind of effort through telemedicine. You got to do labs. You got to know whether your patient is taking the medication or not.
Mm. All right, Ray Tomasi, president and founder of the Gosnold Innovation Center in Falmouth, which is an addiction treatment center. Ray, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Deb.
Joining us also now is John Rosenthal. He's co-founder of PARI, which is the Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative, and he's actually joining us on the line from Washington, D.C., where he attended President Trump's announcement. Hi there, John.
Hi, Deb.
So what was it like to be there for the announcement today?
Well, let me first say that I gave up my invitation and gave it to a police chief from Ohio who was exposed and experienced horrific overdose rates in his county of Olmsted Township, Ohio. So he is a PARI partner. He hadn't been invited, and I thought it was more important, frankly, to have police chiefs who are on the front lines at that announcement than me. I will say that it was an honor that PARI was invited to the White House again today. And in fact, you know, our chiefs were asked to be on the stage with the president. That said, I personally, and I think I can speak for our 320 police chiefs in 31 states, I'm very disappointed. This declaration falls far short of a national emergency that is this year will result in 64,000 of us dead from overdoses, 175 people a day. And, you know, if this were George W. Bush, we'd be saying, once again, all hat, no cattle. I mean, this is all talk, no action, and no funding. And, you know, tomorrow, you know, or today and tomorrow and every day, you know, another 175 people are going to die from preventable overdoses.
Mm. Yeah. So what would you have liked to have seen? More funding? I mean, that's what we're hearing. We're getting statements that are pouring in now since the president wrapped this up, which was really just about a half hour ago or so now. And a lot of them are critical. Attorney General Healey has said that more needs to be done. Congressman Moulton is saying that this is not enough to address this crisis. We've heard from even the Mass Democrats actually asking for Governor Baker to resign from President Trump's opioid commission because they feel that the president has not gone far enough in making this declaration today. I mean, what would you like to see as someone who has tried to work with law enforcement to bridge or perhaps better ease the intersection of what the criminal justice system and the substance use treatment world?
Well, we really don't have to look much farther than the landmark legislation signed into law by Governor Baker and supported by Democrats and Republicans in Massachusetts. You know, that legislation makes it easier for law enforcement and families to access life-saving overdose-blocking naloxone. It holds medical schools accountable to have pain management curriculums. It holds hospitals accountable to have management plans before discharge for folks who are suffering with the disease of addiction. It really holds all the stakeholders accountable except Big Pharma, who actually created this epidemic. So we have to look at what Massachusetts has done. I think the president's commission was right on. It was chaired by the governor of New Jersey, and Governor Baker was on it. And I think it was largely ignored. I've spent a lot of time with folks recently in Washington around this issue, and it's abundantly clear that this president doesn't want to spend any money on this epidemic or really any other public health or environmental issue. He strictly wants to support a massive tax cut. So it's a shame. I mean, you really couldn't expect much from this president, given the fact that, you know, he's trying to cut access to Medicaid, where 80% of treatment funding comes from. So just look at Massachusetts, and that's what we need to replicate.
All right. Thanks so much, John Rosenthal, co-founder of the Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative. Thanks, John, for joining us.
Thanks, Deb.
Again, we just want to reiterate here, in case you're just tuning in, President Trump did, in fact, declare the opioid crisis a nationwide public health emergency today. The declaration lasts for 90 days. It can be renewed, but it comes with no dedicated funding. The White House does say it will allow officials to use existing money to better fight the opioid crisis, and they also say they're going to urge Congress during end-of-the-year budget negotiations to add more cash to a public health emergency fund. Well, joining us to talk about that is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Thanks for being with us, Senator.
No, thank you for having me on.
So what does this mean exactly, asking Congress to add new cash to this public health emergency fund to help deal with the opioid crisis? Do you think that that is a way to handle this?
Well, he didn't tell us how much more money he wanted. He did tell us that he wants to build a wall across our Mexican border. We know that costs $25 billion. We did not hear the president say that he wants $25 billion or $45 billion or $100 billion to deal with the opioid crisis, because the president has no intention of asking for the amount of money that deals with the magnitude of the problem. So these are words, not actions. He's actually in the outline that was released as part of this, going to actually take money from HIV/AIDS and move it over to opioids. That's just robbing Peter to pay Paul. There was no mention of a mandate that doctors and nurses have to have mandatory prescribing education on opioids. Too many of them have no training at all, and yet they're handing out these dangerous opioids. And there was no words about taking on the insurance industry to ensure that they are, in fact, giving parity to these diseases. None of the tough decisions that had to be made. And that's why Senator Casey of Pennsylvania and I introduced a bill yesterday calling for $45 billion to be spent on this emergency, a specific number matching the magnitude of the problem.
And you know, that bill that you're talking about, though, has no Republican sponsors. Do you think that has a reasonable chance of passing here?
That's exactly the point. If the Republicans were sincere about this issue, we would hear about how many billions of dollars that they wanted to spend. Because ultimately, a vision without funding is an hallucination. And so the president never mentioned how much money he's going to spend. That should have been after a year of promising action to the voters of New Hampshire and Wisconsin and Ohio. By now, he should have figured out the magnitude of the problem and how much money he was going to recommend. Still, another opportunity is passed. And instead, he is talking this week to the Republicans about cutting Medicaid, which today is the primary source of funding to take care of people with opioid addictions. Mm.
If the White House could do one thing, just one, what would you like to see happen to address this crisis?
If I had the president do one thing, it would be to say he was going to appropriate tens of billions of dollars that would be used for treatment, that you could give hope to families. There's 2 million families in our country without treatment. There are tens of thousands of families in Massachusetts that do not have access to the funding that makes treatment for their family member possible. This is what they're desperately waiting for. You need a bed. You need someone who's helping you. You need someone to over months, perhaps years, walk you through this problem so you can see the light at the other end of this terrible disease. And none of that happened today.
You know, right before we spoke with you, we spoke with John Rosenthal, who's the co-founder of the Police Addiction and Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative. And he said that what he felt this announcement from the president on opioids today was really a president that showed he was more concerned about tax cuts than about the opioid crisis. And so in the House this morning, a budget resolution passed by a close vote. And a big part of that is the GOP tax overhaul that moves to reconciliation now. I mean, in talking with your colleagues, do you think that this is going to go forward?
I know one thing. The president is going to put every bit of political capital he has on this attempt to cut Medicaid by 1 $1 trillion in order to accommodate a tax break for the upper one percentile in our country. What does that mean? It means the same thing that it meant when the president was trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. 2.8 million Americans get their coverage for addiction under the Affordable Care Act. $90 billion would have been taken out that helps families in our country. And what right now the president is just repeating the very same program over here for tax cuts in order to fund that, cut Medicaid. In order to do that, people are going to lose the substance treatment which they need for their family member.
Mm-hmm. And aside from Medicaid, though, there are other provisions there, such as eliminating state and local tax deductions. What might that mean for folks in Massachusetts?
For people in Massachusetts, an elimination of the state and local tax deduction means a dramatic tax increase, for 30-40% of the families in the state of Massachusetts. It will be dramatic. Right now, they're able to write off those taxes. When you can't write them off, that means that you're just going to have to pay on those taxes in a way that no family in Massachusetts has ever had to do. So it's devastating to our state, even as we receive back from the federal government one of the lowest percentages of federal spending of any state in the union. Some studies say it's as low as only 83 cents on the dollar that we get back. And so this is, again, just taking injury and adding it to another insult. And so that's why our delegation is going to stand and fight, and we're going to try to align ourselves with Democrats and Republicans in states that are going to see a dramatic tax increase so that we can block that from ever becoming a final part of the tax bill.
And what about the debate that's been happening about 401k plans and how they may or may not be a part of all of this? What do you say to that?
Well, for people in by the millions across our country, 401k plans are the only addition to Social Security that they can use in order to have some promise in retirement, because the traditional retirement plan that most Americans were in for generations are now gone for too many people. And their only substitute is a 401k plan. And if you eliminate something like that, you're saying to people, you're on your own. There's no help coming from the federal government. It's Social Security and nothing else. Your company isn't going to give you a pension. And we're going to create a generation, once again, of impoverished seniors in our country, because our country isn't putting together a plan to encourage people to save.
Right. But taxing 401k plans, is that on the table, or is everything on the table right now?
The president says that he wants the 401k plans to be made sacred, but I don't hear a chorus from the Republican leaders up here in the House and Senate. They seem to still want to keep that on the table, along with the state and local tax deduction. And they are absolutely committed to having the single largest amount of money made available to give the tax breaks to the upper one percentile.
And chances of that happening, Senator, what do you predict?
I think that we have to go through three phases: political education, political activation, political implementation. The more that we can get out what the details are of this bill and how it really badly hurts middle-class families in our country, saving for retirement, having the state and local tax deduction, maybe even putting the home deduction on the table as well. They still haven't absolutely removed that from the table. All of these things are can be identified as Achilles' heels, and the better we do it is the closer we come to the day where maybe we can break off a couple of these Republicans the way we did on the Affordable Care Act and have them, out of good conscience, just say it's not good for ordinary families in our country.
All right. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. If you live in Boston and you're ordering a package from Amazon next month, you might not have to worry about delivery. Amazon Key is an internet-connected smart lock and surveillance camera combo that allows Amazon delivery drivers to open your door and drop off packages even if you are not home. Hiawatha Bray is a Tech Lab columnist for the Boston Globe, and he has some concerns about this. He joins us to tell us about them. Hiawatha, hello.
Hi.
So in your latest column, you write, quote, "We let Google, Facebook, Amazon, and other internet companies learn pretty much all there is to know about our lives, trusting that they won't abuse the privilege, but then shrugging it off when we learn that they sometimes do." Why not give them our keys, Hiawatha?
Well, that's the point. And I think that's what they're counting on. And I got to say, I think some significant percentage of the U.S. population will probably go along because of the old balance that we've seen people have to figure out between privacy and convenience. And so far in America, the overwhelming edge goes to convenience, and people are prepared to sacrifice a remarkable amount of privacy for convenience. And I think that's going to happen here, too. I don't think most people are going to end up using it because it's a little expensive, and there are a lot of people who live in apartments where it's not suitable. But I think a lot of single-family home dwellers are probably going to take a look at it.
How does it exactly work, Amazon Key? Can you describe it?
Well, you have to start by understanding that there have been for a while on the market companies like August is the name of one of them that make these devices that are actually locks for your door that can be controlled remotely over the internet. They connect to your home Wi-Fi system, and you can whip out a smartphone and lock and unlock your door when you're not there. And this is actually the reason or one of the reasons why people buy them, so that somebody, like if they need the plumber to come over, they can unlock the door when they're not at home. So these have been around for a little while. They haven't caught on in a big way. But what Amazon's planning to do is sell a system like this for $250. It will have the camera and the lock. It will automatically lock and unlock your door, but it will also have a high-resolution video camera so you can see who's going in and out. Then when you order something from Amazon, they will give you a window of delivery, like within 4 hours of when it's going to be delivered. And when the delivery person gets there, he'll have an app on his smartphone that will tell them, "I'm here, unlock the door." And Amazon will remotely unlock the door. He's supposed to open the door, put the package in, close the door, and leave. You can see the whole thing on TV. The video will be broadcasting, and you, the customer, can watch it live.
How would Amazon, though, vet? I think the biggest concern would be, how do I know who these people are, right? So how would Amazon vet the delivery people?
Well, yeah, you know, the usual thing, background checks of various kinds. Lots of companies do that, and it's not perfectly normal. But it's actually fascinating because this ties into another thing. This is behind-the-scenes stuff that consumers don't care about. Amazon is on this huge campaign to take control of the entire delivery process. They're tired of spending. They spend $16 billion a year. Much of it goes to the U.S. Postal Service, FedEx, UPS. They are trying to take over all of that. They would ultimately like to deliver all their packages through Amazon's own service, and that's what they're doing here. These guys will all be working for Amazon. No postal workers, no UPS workers. They'll all be Amazon employees. They're trying to bring it all in-house.
Not only are they potentially saving money here, but also isn't there a big issue with packages going missing and things like that?
Oh, absolutely.
Isn't that another reason
here?
What's happening
with
that?
This is all part of what's known as the last mile problem. One of the most difficult things when you deliver things to people is that last mile. I mean, this thing could come from all over, from China. And the most complicated part of getting it to you is getting it from the local warehouse to your house. And one of the reasons is a lot of the times people aren't home. And that costs them millions of dollars in things like having to redeliver packages, or they get left on shelves or on steps and they get stolen. This is a big part of it. And that's certainly one of the things that motivates them.
Because of that, some retailers have said you can order online and then pick up at a location. How could Amazon work on that and make that a reality as well if someone was uncomfortable with allowing a delivery person to open their door and drop it off?
Could they work on it? Good heavens, yes. They're already working on it. They got these things called Amazon lockers. A lot of them are available in places like 7-Eleven stores. And guess what, everybody? That's one of the minor reasons why they bought Whole Foods. This is a key part of it. They're putting these things in Whole Foods. So if you live near a Whole Foods and you order something from Amazon and you don't want them to come into your house, just say, drop it at the nearest Whole Foods and I'll pick it up when I get there. Oh, yeah, they're doing everything they can think of to try to solve this problem. You know about the drones. They're still thinking about that. There are even people, I don't know, I didn't mention this in my column, who are working on the idea of robots running up and down the street. They're already being tested in some parts of Europe where the robot drives down the street and drops a package on your front step. So there are lots of people trying to solve this problem.
And how much does it cost? You mentioned it's expensive. Does it depend on what market you're in and all that other stuff?
No. What costs is the device that you have to attach to your door. It's $250 with a video camera and the lock, and they will install it for you free. Amazon will send somebody to your house just to install it. So you got to trust this guy. And he's going to put it in your house, and they will charge you nothing for that. You must also be a member of Amazon Prime, which is $99 a year, their buyer's club. I think something like half of the households in America are now Amazon Prime customers. I forget the number. It's a very large percentage. And they should be, because there's lots of good reasons to belong to Amazon Prime. But yeah, what I'm concerned about, and I've mentioned this, is that it is part of this idea that corporations like Amazon are just trying to push the envelope. They're constantly trying to figure out how much of your privacy will you be willing to give up?
Right.
How much intimacy will you let us have into your personal life? And every time we have answered, oh yeah, that's okay. We'll tell you what we think. We'll tell you who we vote for. We'll tell you what we buy. So now they're going to say, oh, well, let us into your house. And people will say, oh, you bet. A couple of more points I have to make very quickly. They, of course, bought Whole Foods. They're talking about, oh, well, we're just going to put this in your door and we're going to leave immediately. That's just for now. Eventually, they're going to want to walk into your house and put ice cream in your refrigerator. They're going to be delivering stuff from Whole Foods, and this is all part of it. They don't want to talk about it yet, but you know that's what they're going to do. They're already talking about, like, plumbers and heating, air conditioning people, because they already have a service where you can hire those people through Amazon Home, and you will be able to let them into your house using this, too. So you can have people walking all over your house, thanks to Amazon.
You know, you mentioned the privacy here winning out, or convenience, rather, winning out over privacy. And I wonder how much of that is generational. And I'm thinking of a quote that Washington Post writer Christine Ember wrote, and she said, Amazon is falls into the category of things that she actually wrote that Silicon Valley proposals, like these proposals from Amazon, fall into the category of things that I, as a 25-year-old, wish I could still get my mother to do for me. Do you think that that's a lot of the thinking here?
I think some of it, but I think that is sometimes exaggerated. I think there are a lot of older people who would look at this and find it very convenient. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if they could pitch it that way. I think it could go either way. The idea that, well, suppose you have, like, my mother has a lot of trouble getting around. She's got people caring for her, but I could easily imagine somebody saying, all right, I'm going to remotely open your door and a guy's going to come into your house and restock your refrigerator. You won't even have to get up. So there are a lot of seniors who will love this.
And what about how Amazon might mitigate the, you know, inevitable security risks here?
Well, all they could do is, you know, basically give these people very serious vetting. By the way, you'll have the camera on, so you'll know that as they leave your house, they're not carrying your 50-inch TV with them as they walk out the door, because they'll be right there on television. But the other security thing, you make a great point, is they've got to make sure that this device, the lock itself, is hack-proof or as close to that as possible. And that's something that really ought to worry me, because these so-called Internet of Things devices so far have tended to have really lousy security. Amazon's got to designed this so that it gets, like, its own security updates on a regular basis, and the customer does nothing at all to make that happen. They just keep it safe and secure and properly patched at all times. Even then, there's always going to be a risk somebody could hack it.
All right. Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the business section of the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, thanks again for being with us.
It's been fun.
Stay with us. Coming up, a novel based on some of the history of uncovering Proctor's Ledge, the newly revealed hanging site during the Salem witch trials. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Thousands of people are flocking to the city of Salem as Halloween approaches. The city's both a symbol of the holiday and a reminder of a gruesome history. It's been 325 years since 19 women were hanged in Salem for practicing witchcraft. Over the summer, Salem officials held a ceremony at a place known as Proctor's Ledge. That area was recently determined to be the historically accurate spot of the first mass hangings connected to the Salem witch trials. The story of uncovering Proctor's Ledge is a big part of the latest novel by Salem author Brynonia Barry. Barry herself is a descendant of Rebecca Nurse, one of the women hanged as a witch. Barry's latest novel, The Fifth Petal, weaves the story of the accused women with present-day research and a dash of mysticism to create a captivating murder mystery. Barry will be speaking this weekend at the Boston Book Festival. We met with her earlier this year at the Salem Athenaeum, one of the oldest private libraries in the country, to talk about her book.
This is great,
isn't it?
It's so quiet.
It is. It's a great place to write.
The Athenaeum smells a bit musty in some spots, with shelves of books lining up along the walls. And out a half-moon window on the second floor, you can see the popular tourist site, the Witch House.
The floor's got a little tilt to
it. It sure does. Yes. Yes.
Here among the books, some of them 3 centuries old, is where Brynonia Barry writes. She shows us the seat at the wooden table where she wrote her latest novel, and she tells us how it came about.
There are a couple times a week when you can come in and just work kind of silently. And it's usually poets in here, and I swear it raises your game to just work in the presence of poets.
Well, let's talk about your new book, which The Fifth Petal, which opens in 2014, and it's Halloween, and we're introduced to the 2 main characters in the book, the police chief of Salem and a woman who is a historian, Rose, who has been traumatized, and she's
suffered from complex trauma.
Oh, yeah, okay,
basically.
That's good. And in that introduction to those characters, you're telling us about Proctor's Ledge as the site where 19 women were hanged.
Right. And one man pressed to death. Yeah.
And Rose was convinced that that was the site of the real hanging, even though the historical records had said it was somewhere else. And this happened in real life. Yeah, explain that.
It did. I was very lucky. I think it's probably the worst kept secret in Salem, is that the Gallows Hill is not the site of the hangings. There were a couple reasons for this, and one is that the hanging bodies had to be visible from town, and Gallows Hill would not have been. It was sort of a cautionary tale, the wages of sin sort of thing. And so we knew that the real hanging site was right near, right behind a Walgreens parking lot, actually. And they will be building a memorial there. As this book went to press, there was a group, the Gallows Hill Project, which was historians. We have many historians in town, and writers and scientists absolutely verified the spot where this all took place. Huh. And so I was very lucky because I had written it. I mean, the research really shows you that that's true.
Right. And so did you know that while you were writing?
I did know
it. Was this something going around town that wasn't the real site for a very long time and was how it figured into your writing?
I think we all anyone who's really studied it sort of knew that. But what I took a chance on was that I said there was not a gallows built ever. There were no historical records of gallows being built. And Salem really had records of every cent they spent. And so I guessed it was a tree, a hardwood, probably an oak. And very luckily for me, I took a chance and said that that's what Rose believed. And very lucky for me, as this went to press, the Gallows Hill Project declared the same thing.
So, yeah, you're very lucky.
I am very lucky. But, all the records sort of led to that. Yeah. So it... I took a chance.
So how much did you have to use records in your writing?
Oh, a lot.
Yeah?
A lot. This book took 5 years, and I think half of it was research. And research not only into Salem's history, but, if you write fiction, there are so many historians here, you better get it right.
You're going to hear.
Yeah, you're going to hear if you get it wrong. And then I was studying other things like music therapy and sound healing and quantum mechanics and all sorts of things that figure in the book. And I think I could have just kept studying and never written the book at all.
Now, this book and your other book, The Lace Reader, and they're set in Salem.
Yes.
They deal with, shall we say, the supernatural sort of reputation of Salem and raise questions about those things. Why do you want to do that in your novels?
Well, I think Salem is a place that sort of celebrates that. There were no witches here in 1692, but we have a lot now. And there are a lot of people who are psychic readers. And you know, I always say to my husband, you better watch what you think when you walk around town because half the people are reading you. So, and I had a mom who was quite prescient in her knowledge of things she shouldn't have known. Certainly when I was younger, knowing where I was when I wasn't supposed to be there and things like this. But so I kind of grew up with this psychic connection. I don't necessarily have it.
No?
But I, maybe a little bit once in a while, but nothing I can really use. Mm-hmm. I can't bet on the lottery or anything. You know? So I always try to include things that can either be theorized by science, but can also exist in this sort of supernatural level. And that's from living in Salem, I think. You're just faced with this a lot.
So when you're writing, would you say this book uses more historical records than others? And, I mean, is this the most historical research you've done for any of your novels?
Yes, it definitely is. Because I really wanted to mirror what happened in 1692. And Rose's character really mirrors Sarah Good's. And so I wanted to look into her history.
And is that how you started thinking about this book?
It is. I started thinking about it originally because I had pitched a book about banshees. And people said, oh, yes, drop everything and do that.
Explain what a banshee is for folks.
A banshee in the Irish culture, certainly the Celtic culture, is someone who predicts death. And a lot of Irish families claim to have one. Usually the banshee moans or wails, and then you know someone in your family is going to die.
And there's a lot of Celtic mythology in
there
the
is.
Book here. Now, when you were doing your research on that, tell me, what did you find in terms of that influence
here
in Salem?
Well, a number of the pagan community worship the Celtic pantheon, so I thought that would be a good one to choose. I mean, it can be Greek or Roman or whatever, but it happens here that there are a lot of people of Irish descent or Scottish or, you know, whatever Celtic religion, and so it's kind of popular. Mm-hmm. So I thought, and I do a lot of consulting with the local pagan community and local witches. So I have all sorts of people I go to for advice, you know. Does this hold true?
Yeah, you do. You run it by, yeah?
I do.
Yeah.
It's... Yep, you have to check with a historian.
Even though it's fiction, you want to make sure that it's why.
I think in order to have the fiction be believable, you really need to make sure everything else is. And in Salem, you know, if you change a location or, you know, you better say so in your acknowledgments because people will call you on it. So because it's odd to write a fiction book about a real place. So I think it has to, the things that are true have to be very true. And you have to make sure, can't take too many liberties with the way a place looks or, you know, where it's situated.
And your own history is from here.
It is.
It is.
So that plays into things quite well.
Right. How did that inform your writing, do you think?
Well, we have, we're related to Rebecca Nurse's family. We also have an accuser hanging from our family tree, and no one has bothered to really look into that. I'm going to do that just because I think that's interesting too. So I think there's a generational guilt that is prevalent in Salem if your family's been here a long time. So that informs my writing as well.
Yeah, your book describes a spectacle that is Halloween in Salem, and there obviously is a lot of interest in witches and the supernatural and psychic abilities. And I'm wondering how you think that balances with this gruesome history of Salem. There was a big debate when they wanted to put a Bewitched statue in the center of town from the television show. And are people, do you think, remembering that history in an appropriate way? Or how would you describe it?
I think we're a town divided, actually.
Really?
I do. I think when I first moved here, there was a movement to ditch the witch, and that didn't mean the new witches who lived in town. That meant the dark history, and that we're known for just that. I mean, we have five libraries. We're the cultural center of the North Shore, and we have a lot going for us. And people come here because of the history. I think the mayor said at that point, we had a bad 9 months several hundred years ago, and no one's ever going to let us forget it. But the fact is, people do come for the history, and now we're trying to show them what else we've got. I think that's it.
And do you think there's renewed interest in things supernatural? Well,
I think so. I mean, there's certainly with Harry Potter and all of that.
Right.
And I think when you feel powerless, you like to believe. And I think that's why children love those stories so much. And I think you like to believe there's some magic beyond yourself that can help you. And I think that's great.
Are there still lessons that you think can be learned?
Oh, I do. I do.
I thought so.
I think that, I mean, that's really why I wrote this book. I think it's a cautionary tale. My thought when I wrote it was, could a witch hunt happen again in Salem? They're certainly happening all over the world. And I mean in different, you know, metaphorically different ways. And if it did happen in Salem, what would it look like? And my mind immediately went to a homeless, mentally ill, you know, someone who's really suffering, who we make other. But I think creating people who are other is something that is, sadly, is happening everywhere. So I think there's a cautionary tale in what happened here.
Brynonia Berry's latest novel is The Fifth Petal. She'll be at the Boston Book Festival this weekend, and more information about that is at our website, radioboston.org. We want to update our top story now. Governor Baker has released a statement reacting to President Trump declaring the opioid epidemic a public health emergency today. The governor says the declaration is a strong step in the right direction. The governor, who's a member of the White House Opioid Commission, says he looks forward to the commission's final report next week, and the governor says he's urging the White House and Congress to fully fund that commission's proposals. That's our show for today. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.